This is an ad by BetterHelp.
Did I talk too much?
I should have handled that better.
Why can't I just let it go?
Why did I do that?
I wish we'd stop thinking so much.
Take a breath. You're not alone. Counseling helps you sort through the noise with qualified professionals. Get matched with a therapist online based on your unique needs and get help with everyday struggles like anxiety or managing tough emotions.
Visit betterhelp.com/randompodcast for 10% off your first month of online therapy. And let life feel better.
Had one of those days, London?
God!
Are you okay?
And you just need a good laugh? We've got you. Because with award-winning Sky shows like Mr. Big Stuff...
We're coming for you.
Robin Ramesh versus...
I feel like it's a punishment.
Either way, I'm in.
Brassic.
I've heard a lot about you.
And brand new US comedies Ted, Hacks and The Paper. You can deal with anything the day throws at you.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
Sky. Believe in better.
Autumn. When the colours change and the breeze is fresher. A time to take stock and start some new autumn rituals. Like cozying up with your fave podcasts. Whilst you immerse yourself, complement your me time with Costa Coffee's Maple Hazel range. Enjoy a silky latte, a refreshing iced latte, or luxurious hot chocolate. It's the taste of autumn in a cup. Head to your nearest Costa Coffee store or Costa Express machine to pick up a Maple Hazel drink while stocks last.
Yeah, but when you think about the amount of money he was making, like I said, heyday.
Oh, man.
You know, there was no
with inflation? Cap, so. Crazy. All right, let me do an intro. 3, 2, 1. Good morning, everybody. Good evening. Who cares? Welcome to another episode of Dropping the Gloves. We got a good one today. Rainey McKay, Michigan Tech alumni, two-time Stanley Cup War winner. I would consider him my friend. We've golfed together. We've hung out together. We played together. Randy, how you doing, bud?
Good. How you doing, John? Thanks for having me.
Can't complain. You know what? It's an honor to have you. I appreciate you jumping on. We had a hiccup a couple days ago, but we figured it out. We got our wives involved and then they smoothed out everything. So here we are. So I want to get back to what we were talking about before I pressed record, because it's fascinating. You think players these days make a ton of money. You know, we just obviously had Kirill Kaprizov. He turned down the $16 million, 8-year, 100 mega, $28 million deal, highest ever. And then we're talking, Randy, and you're telling me that guys 30 years ago were making a ton of money. And I just, you forget that the salary cap used to never exist. And you played in an era where guys were making some pretty good dough compared to the guys these days. I don't know. Tell me about the Scott Stevens saga and you going to the Jersey Devils, because I thought that's fascinating.
Okay. We started talking about salaries and you were saying I did pretty good. And I did. And I said I played in the heyday. And then, you know, I reminded you about guys in the late 90s and how much money they were actually making before the salary cap. So when I was saying that I played with Scott Stevens, Marty Brewer, and we were talking about their salaries, well, how Scotty ended up in Jersey was St. Louis had just signed Scotty to a big deal, like a big contract. And then they turned around the next year and they signed Brendan Shanahan. And what happened was, if you couldn't come to an agreement on a group two free agent on a trade type thing, a salary arbitrator would come in and each team had to offer something. And the arbitrator ruled on what side he went with. So he didn't just pick, you know, Scotty Stevens out of the blue. Lou Lamoriello asked for Scotty Stevens. St. Louis, you know, never thought they'd lose him. They lost Scotty Stevens. And that's the reason Detroit threw me, it was the same year, threw me in the pot when Detroit signed Troy Crowder from New Jersey. So I wasn't going to go. Illich himself told me I wasn't going anywhere. And after they lost Scott Stevens, Lou was asking for Bob Probert. So Lou won with Scotty. He was asking for Bob. So Detroit had to sweeten the pot a little bit. I had fought a little bit. I was young. So they threw me in the mix.
So how does that work? Because nowadays you throw an offer sheet, but a player doesn't come in, you know, return. And just to go back to the Scott Stevens, to put the nail in the coffin for St. Louis, they got Scott Stevens the year before.
Yeah.
From Washington for, they had to give up 5 first round draft picks.
Was that
to
what it was?
Washington for Scotty. Then he turns around and he goes to the New Jersey Devils the very next year, which is insane.
He was really upset. Like, if you remember, we were in the same hotel because we both got shipped there at the same time. And him and the wife and their family was not very happy. I mean, you know, they went there thinking they were going to be in St. Louis for their career or whatever. A year later, he turns around, he ends up in Jersey. And then obviously it grew on him and he stayed there the rest of his career. And everything worked out well with 3 Stanley Cups. But back in the day, that was how it was rewarded. The arbitrator picked one side or the other. So So that was 91. The year before 1990, Scotty Stevens signed for, I'm going to make numbers up, but I'm not far off, for $3 or $4 million a year.
No, Randy, it was $5.1 million for 4 years he signed.
So 5.1 a year.
Yeah, a year. So 20 million bucks for 4 years he signed in 1990. Yeah.
So add inflation to that, that's 35 years ago. That's more than double. It's quadruple. So yeah, that's,
and this is a young defenseman.
Like, that's like 20 something million bucks in today's with inflation. So that's crazy.
So when you're playing, did you know that, like, dude, were you around when the salary cap was enacted, or were you out of the league by then?
I retired a year before that.
So did the players know that that was coming, or the owners, they were talking? Yeah.
So we sat out in 94. We missed a half a season, and that was the year we won our first cup in 95. Mm-hmm. So, and they got us prepared. They wanted to do the salary cap, wanted, and Bob Goodenow, you know, crammed it down our throats for 2 years. You better be ready. You better be ready. This is going to be a long fight, blah, blah, blah. And so we went into it, and we didn't get back until, we didn't start the season until January. But we conceded, and I was at the time an assistant player rep, or I don't know if I was then or became one. Why not cap the rookies? So I was a proponent. I was all fine and dandy with capping the rookies. Well, you got to look at the contracts that came out right before that were Pronger, Alexander Daig. You know, these guys, 18-year-olds, Alexander Daig never made it, but he signed a $2 million a year contract at 18. Mm-hmm. That's in 91, 92, 93. So that's when we decided, you know, cap the rookies. They still were able to make a really decent amount of money. But that way, over time, if the owners worked it right, they could keep the salaries down. But it was getting crazy. When you're signing 18-year-olds for $2 million a year, you know, and the league average was probably $700,000 or something. I don't know what it was, but it was nowhere near $1 million back in that
day. Even that's still a lot of money. Even $700,000 for the league minimum, that's still a lot of money for back then. So
that was a minimum. That was the average, I think.
Average. So you guys were prepped for, and I want to go back and talk about all the Devils and stuff. This is fascinating to me because I went through a lockout too, and we lost half a season arguing over, you know, escrow and stuff like that. We already had the cap. That was a given. So
what year was that, John?
That was 2014, I believe.
So you missed a half year that year too?
But yeah, we got back to work in January. Yeah.
So they already had the cap.
Yep.
And then
they already had the cap, but we didn't have an even split of the HRR. So we were making 67% of the hockey-related revenue. They were making 33%, and they wanted it split at 50-50. And then they wanted some other concessions. So we sat out half the season saying this is BS. Because you know how the league works. They came in, we want 70% of the HRR. We want you guys to roll back your salaries. They ask for everything. And so, yeah, we lost half the season. We ended up getting a pension, though. That was a good thing that came out of it. But it was it stunk.
Yeah, I forgot about that. But you look back when we were fighting, you know, in 94, and we held off the salary cap. You know, we capped the rookies. But, you know, one of the big things was, when people don't realize, you look, take the Detroit Red Wings, for example. You know, Ilitch and Little Caesars owned the Red Wings, probably owned the building too. But then all the subsidiaries of, you know, Detroit Red Wings ran the concessions, they ran the parking, they ran all of that. Well, that didn't fall on the bottom line because that was leased out to all his sub-companies.
Yeah, and they're so different companies.
When you're coming to find out what, you know, revenue you're actually generating, there were so many ways to hide the revenue. That's part of the reason we fought it so hard too.
And they're still like that. We had two audits. We audited the Nashville Predators, the Columbus Blue Jackets, and a few other teams as the NHLPA because we knew they were hiding money. Where the parking structure is a part of the rink, but it's his off company. And you make millions on that, but it's not reported under your bottom line.
Yeah,
it's
like you're renting it to them for $100,000 and they're making $3 million off it or whatever.
Yeah. And so they were just hiding money left, right. So it got to the point where these teams had to write us a check a few years later. They fought it tooth and nail, but we ended up winning. But it's just brutal. I don't know. They're good at hiding money. But
well, it's a business. And I agree. I mean, if you're an owner and you invest that much money, you should be able to make some kind of a profit. And I'm sure there's a lot that don't. You know, if you've got a losing team and you're not in a big, strong hockey market, there's got to be some tough downtimes.
Well, that's why there's escrow now. So the team has no incentive to put a good team on the ice because we pay all their losses. And so what happens is they have a losing team. They can write that off on their taxes saying, oh, look at, I lost $50, $60 million. But then the players come in and make them whole and give them that money on the side. So it's a win-win for the owners. They almost have a team like a tax write-off. And so that's why you see teams like Arizona stunk for years, but the owners are making money hand over fist.
Yeah.
But anyway, so let's go back, Randy, because I wanted to go back to you. I know you. I've known you for a long time. And then when I start digging into your stats, to me, you're just a regular guy who I met at Michigan Tech, just a normal guy. But then you look at your stats and look at your playing career. It's like, holy crap. Like, this guy was a legit star in the NHL for a long time. You almost played 1,000 games. You played almost 150 in the playoffs, two Stanley Cups, and not just a passenger in the Stanley Cup. Like, you were like almost leading your team and scoring big goals, playing on one of the most influential lines in the playoffs for the New Jersey Devils. And you're just some, you know, random guy who lives in Houghton, Michigan now. It's so bizarre that you're this guy, but then in Houghton, you're just like, regular Randy McKay. So yeah, it's cool for you to come on here. But anyways, not trying to blow smoke up your behind, but I've done it quite a bit, but I did a good job there. So I want to talk about that going to the Devils because you're with the Red Wings and I noticed the Pims, man. You came out of the gate just fighting and you were not just fighting nobodies. We'll get to that in a second, but just fighting. At what point did you just decide, I'm just going to fight? Like, this is what I need to do to be in the NHL.
Well, when I first turned pro, I mean, I realized in my head, what's going to separate me from the guy next to me that's the same, almost the same exact type player. You know, if he was scoring, if I played grittier, which I did in college, you know, I was a hitter, I was a forechecker. You know, I was fortunate enough my senior year, I averaged a point a game in college. Then went to the minors right after my senior year for the last 20 games in the minors, or 15 or whatever I played. And then, so the coach knew me, and I had a little bit of taste of what the pro hockey was. So I signed a one-year AHL contract, and I got off to a gangbuster my first year. I was on my way to scoring, you know, 40 goals in the minors, and that's when Detroit signed me to a NHL deal right before Christmas and said they were going to call me up. Well, they did. They didn't call me up until the end of January, but they signed me right before Christmas and I signed my NHL deal. And so that goes by. So I get called up that year. So in January, I get called up. And I remember Jacques Lemaire telling Sean Burr, who's a third-line center, you better pick your offensive game. I'm giving you a goal scorer. So when I first got called up, I was a bit of an offensive player. So I did that for a year. The second year, I stayed. Again, I started in the minors, played half a year up. And then the third year, we had a coaching change. Brian Murray came in. And I had had Barry Melrose for half a year in the minors the year before. And I remember talking to him during training camp, and he said, Randy, if you want to stay up here, you better start dropping the gloves in the exhibition games because Brian Murray doesn't think much of you. And Barry was great. Barry loved me. I loved Barry. And he just was honest with me, and he said, if you want to stay. So that's how I started fighting. And in order to stay in the lineup in Detroit, I started fighting. Then the whole I was compensation a jersey. And at one point, they actually told me to tone it down a bit because they didn't need me fighting. But I got dealt for Troy Crowder. So I kind of was filling that void.
Yeah.
So, you know, I fought and played, and I got a great opportunity. And then, like you said, I played on the crash line, got a lot of notoriety, and, you know, played some good minutes. And then, you know, was able to put up some good points for a few of my years.
Well, hell yeah. You that Detroit Red Wings team, it was a decent team, and they had some good players on it. Talk about playing with Yzerman and Fedorov and Probert and these guys, because you're a young kid probably looking up to all these guys, and you're trying to, you know, hang around. And this is a soon-to-be, like, dynasty in the NHL.
Yeah, so Fedorov would be tough to say. I don't even think he spoke English at all. That was his first year. So Fedorov's first year was, I believe, my last, maybe my second to last year in Detroit. But Yzerman, I'll give him credit. As a captain and as a leader, he wasn't a big talker. He wasn't a rah-rah guy. He was very quiet, but he was the last guy out of the weight room, and he was the last guy off the ice almost every day. Hmm. You know, and you're talking about a guy that's putting up 100 points a year, and he's still, you know, like I said, working the hardest off the ice and working the hardest on the ice, you know, and then you see why, you know, he was devoted and he was talented and he succeeded. Bob Probert was a great guy. I wish I had longer time to get to know him before I was dealt, but just a big teddy bear.
Is he?
Gentle, laid back, super laid back, nice guy, like really nice guy, you know, opposite of a fighter you'd see him fight.
You know, you guys had a tough team. You had him, Joey Kosher. You had McCrimmon, Keith Primo. Like, what
Primo
was that?
Was young. We had, what's his name? McClellan came from Edmonton. He was a fighter. So, yeah, so it was easy for me to break in the NHL that way with those guys surrounding me.
Did they ever give you any notes? Because going to Tech, you don't fight at all, right? Like, it's not a league for fighting. And all of a sudden, you're thrust into this position. Someone tells you have to fight to stay, and then you're learning from. I think Joey Kosher is one of the most underrated fighters ever. I think he's top five. That's how good he was. Did they ever pull you aside in practice and be like, "Hey, kid, like this is what you need to do here"?
I don't think so. I helped a couple of younger guys coming up, but I don't think I ever. What I based my fighting style on was watching Bob Probert. Not that he taught me. I just watched him fight. And I realized what he was doing. He had a little bit longer reach than I did, so I was still kind of effective. Was for the first 15, 20 seconds of the fight, I'd try to get a good grip on the right and lock out. And then let them exude all their energy in the first 20, 30 seconds. And once they started slowing down, then I would come through and then try to freaking take over the fight. Which then would make you look like you won the fight because you had all the, you know, you're throwing all the punches in the second half. So, yeah, my endurance and just my sitting back, trying to tire them out and then going at them. Which is, if you watch Proby, it's kind of what he did. He just kind of threw them out there, ragdolled them a little bit. And when they got tired, then he started to make you look silly. But getting to Joey, I just played with Joey in an alumni game on Saturday. He was a scary fighter. He wasn't a flashy fighter because all he had to do was hit you with one of his punches. You know, he was throwing them from downtown, and he was the old farm boy where, honest to God, his right side and his forearms and his right side of his body was bigger than his left from, you know, pitching hail bays all day. But, he would break helmets, and if you look at his hands still, he's got scars on his knuckles and his hands beat up, but he's still got good hands. He's a hell of a golfer. So he's got some feeling in his hands.
I'm looking at your numbers. It's crazy because nowadays, like, the leader in PIMS gets like 95, 100. And Joey Kosher had 253. You had 183. Keith Primo had 106. Gerard Gallant had 111. Yeah, Bobby had 315. Like, Sean Burr had 112. How do you get that many PIMS? Like, what was it, just bench clearing brawls, or what was happening?
I was only ever in one bench clearing brawl, I think, and that was with Jersey. There was a lot of fights, probably a lot of 10 minutes. So you could fight three times in a game, Your third fight, I didn't think you could fight more than that before, but then they came up with the instigator. If you instigate it, you could fight three times and then you're kicked out. And, you know, but you look back at some of the guys that had tons of PIMs, you know, like a Rob Ray for Buffalo, for example. He didn't fight 48 times in a season to get 250 penalty minutes. He got a lot of 10-minute misconducts. He got a lot of, you know, if you look at my career, I mean, two of my years, I had 28 fight majors. You know, that's only 140, that's only 140 minutes. So really, you know, you got to get a lot of 10-minute misconducts. You got to get a lot of that in order to start getting up over 200.
It's crazy to look at your stats. Like, you have 250 like, that's bizarre. Like, and like, you're not a big guy. And this is no slight against you. It's almost like a badge of honor saying you're 6'2", probably playing weight like 210, 250, 207. And you're fighting. I just listed off some guys who you've fought. It's not guys your size. It's Dave Brown. It's Link Gates. It's Grimson, Brashear, Belak, Domi. Like, these are big dudes. Like, did you ever just stop to think, like, what am I doing?
Yeah, I tried to pick my spots, too, a little bit. So my second year in Detroit, I was, you know, I'd finished the playoffs with Detroit the year before, so I got hurt. Three games, came back, played in the playoffs, went down to the minors, won the Calder Cup, the AHL trophy. So the next year I get to camp and I'm expecting to make the team. I really am. Well, camp comes to conclusion. And when I did play, I was playing fourth line, like literally 4 or 5 minutes a game in exhibition.
Oh, no.
They go to send me down and they tell me I didn't produce. I said, well, I didn't play, but in our inner squad games, I had 3 goals in 3 games, so that wasn't too bad. So whatever, so that the night before, a couple nights before I sent down, back-to-back games, we had a home-and-home against Minnesota North Stars. I fought Tenorti and Link Gates back-to-back nights, and I got spanked in both.
The missing link.
I hung in there, but yeah, good job, kid. I got a pat on the back that night. Next day, I got sent down. So
why, like, why fight Link Gates? Because he was probably 260, 6'5", like just a monster.
Have you met him ever?
No, I would love to.
When he ended up in San Jose, he was staying in a hotel we were at for some reason. I never met him, but going down in the morning and get a coffee, he was right in front of me. And literally, I'm just shaking my head going, I can't, like, his shoulders were twice as wide as me. He was just, his hands were twice the size of mine. Like, he was a beast.
So yeah, why not just say no? Fight. No, thank you, Mr. Gates. We're not going to fight.
It was exhibition. I think he challenged me. I had to try. Tenorti I hung in with, and he was a big, tall, lanky guy. But Link Gates just, I don't think it was a big fight. I think he threw me around pretty quick. And I fought him one other time during the regular season when he was with San Jose, but that was it. Again, probably the hardest I've ever been hit. So we're fighting. We're fighting and he locks me out. And I'm throwing like 3-4 and I'm friggin', you know, he hasn't thrown one yet. I'm in control, I think. My punches are about 3-4 inches away from his face. And then all of a sudden, bam, boom. It felt like I slid on my back from the red line to the blue line. Like, that's how hard I was hit. I don't know how far I went. I probably just went straight back, but it felt like he just lights out.
That's your fault. You agreed to fight him again, Randy. That's all on you. That's too
funny. I was
right
off the open face-off, too. It was a little embarrassing. But.
So he's fresh as a daisy. He's been thinking about this for a couple of days, and you're like, yeah, sure, let's go.
I said I was looking good for 10 or 15 seconds.
Oh my gosh. All right, let's get into the meat of this, the fun stuff, the Stanley Cups. But first, before we get to your first Stanley Cup, and gosh, you've won 2 Stanley Cups. I'm so jealous of you. So before that 1995 Cup, you obviously are part of that famous series of Mark Messier in 1994. You guys got a good team. You're flying. And as I was, you know, looking you up, I'm like, holy crap, he was in that series where Messier just made the famous shot call, say, we're going to win Game 6 and Game 7. It's all over the New York Post. You're obviously in New Jersey, right across the river. I played for the Rangers, and we had gone to New Jersey all the time. It stunk. But what were you guys saying in the room when you're up 3-2 like, are you just laughing at this chump? Like, you're going to win the next two? Are you kidding me? What was the response like?
Hello, sweater weather. Bring on cozy duvet days, crisp air, and crunchy leaves. Out is out. And the original pumpkin spice latte is in. Handcrafted with our signature espresso and seasonal pumpkin flavors, then topped with whipped cream, cinnamon, and nutmeg. Hot or iced? PSL, it's here. Only at the Starbucks Coffee Company. Subject to availability while stocks last.
This is an ad by BetterHelp.
Did I talk too much?
I should have handled that better.
Why can't I just let it go?
Why did I do that?
I wish I would stop overthinking so much.
Why did I do that?
Take a breath. You're not alone. Let's talk about what's going on.
Counseling helps you sort through the noise with qualified professionals. And online therapy makes it convenient. See if it's for you. Visit betterhelp.com/randompodcast for 10% off your first month of online therapy.
The amount of pauses, what's the word I'm looking for? When he said that, okay, if they didn't win both those games, and if they didn't win, you would never have heard that quote ever again.
Yeah.
So really, it wasn't a win-lose situation. It was kind of like, he's a captain. He has to show, that he believes, and that's what he came out and said it. Well, yeah, it took him to overtime the second game. So, I mean, we hung in there. Game seven, we went to overtime, and we blew it. And he did get a hat trick in the one game, in game six, I think.
Yeah, he did back it up. But was he that good? Could you, like, because you talk about bulletin board material, you're like, come on. Like, it was front page of the New York Post. It was a pretty big deal.
Yeah, he was a leader. He was a skilled, tough, he did it all, and he that's why his career was so long and he was so successful.
All right, well, let's move on to the fun stuff. So you mentioned you got there with Scott Stevens. You're joining this New Jersey Devils team. Could you tell it was up and coming? It was a good team when you got there. You obviously had Lou Lamoriello, one of the best GMs ever. You got Jacques Lemaire, one of the greatest coaches ever. I played for Jacques in Minnesota. Absolutely love the guy. And you team up, and all of a sudden you find yourself, you're on a line with like a young Bobby Holik and a tough-as-nails Peluso. Was that line put together as soon as you got to New Jersey, or did you have to kind of figure yourself out?
So my first year was 91-92 in Jersey. We had Tom McVie as our coach.
Okay.
And then 93, we had Herb Brooks.
Herb Brooks, that's right.
And then Jacques Lemaire came in. So then that first year with Jacques, we went to the conference final and lost to Messier. Mm-hmm. And then the next year, we won the cup with him. Yeah, loved this coach by far. And another, to talk about Minnesota, Billy Guerin, I've heard him say too, it was by far his favorite coach he ever had.
Yeah, so easy to play for a guy like that. And then you had Larry Robinson too, who I played for as well in San Jose, oddly enough. And winning that cup in 94-95 with that team, because I've skated with Stefan Richie, I've skated with a few of those guys. How integral was your line, first of all, but even just these young guys like a Claude Lemieux, he was coming back, actually. He had already won a couple of cups with Montreal, but how integral were these young guys? Because when you look at this roster, you got a Brian Rolson who's 21, you got a Billy Guerin who's 23, you got a Sergei Breland who's 20 years old, and you're not that old yourself, you're pretty young, but how fun was that to join that young group, everybody in their prime, and then he won a Stanley Cup?
Yeah, by then, and Richie and Claude came the same year as I did. They came, or Claude might have come the year before me. Reach came in, I think, the same year.
No kidding.
With Tom Chorsky.
Okay.
And, Claude, obviously, his playoff success he's had, and he's had, good regular season numbers, but it's where he comes through in the playoffs. And Reach loved the guy. And it was said that he just wanted out of Montreal. He didn't want the pressure anymore of Montreal. Hmm. And, I've heard the quote of Reach could have scored 50 every year if he wanted to. And that's how good he was.
Yeah.
And I'm almost a believer in, if he really wanted to, that's what he just hung in there getting 30-something goals every year. but big, powerful legs, could shoot, strong. You know, he could do it all. But he was Jacques' whipping boy. Jacques loved
him. Oh, really?
Yeah, him. Well, Claude a little bit too. But what's funny about him and Larry both being behind a bench. So I'm from Montreal. And what they didn't realize, my dad had a bright idea. If I was going to, what he believed, he was a business person in Montreal. If I was going to stay in Montreal and do something business-wise, I need to know French. So I got put in French school. Parents didn't speak French. No one could, and I was in French school. I had a tutor from across the street. So get to coaching. Well, the only three Frenchmen on our team were Marty, who's in net, and then you got Claude and Reich. And usually when he was pissed off, it was at one of them two most of the time. So the two coaches, or whenever they wanted to say something else that they didn't want anyone to understand, they would talk French to each other behind a bench. Well, they never knew I was bilingual. I knew every word they were saying.
Did you ever tell them you turn around like, I can hear everything you're saying?
I told Jacques in the 20th anniversary of the 95 Cup reunion. I think that's the first time I told him then. I said, by the way, when you were talking, I understood everything.
That's too funny. We'll talk about the crash line, because that was put together obviously before the Stanley Cup happened, and you guys were such a huge part of that team. I was actually talking to Reich about that, about the cup and how it was in New Jersey. And he's like, the one guy who was pretty much like underrated was a Bobby Holík, because he's just a young kid. How huge was he to that line? Because Peluso's not a playmaker. Let's be honest, he's a tough guy. And then yourself is kind of a hybrid. How good was Bobby Holík?
He was excellent. And if you look back, you know, it probably hindered his offensive production for two or three years. But, you know, he was a first round pretty early pick, I believe. Not top five, but he was still
good. Number 10 overall, yeah.
And a big, solid, like he would hurt guys in practice, not trying. He'd always be, oh, I didn't mean it. You know, 230 pounds running over someone by mistake, which is what he did. But, we were successful because we were the only line, really, that, you know, everyone thought of as sitting back playing the trap. Well, when we were on, you know, we didn't sit back all the time and play the trap. We were forecheckers. We went in. We went, you know, hog wild. But Jacques knew how to use us. You know, after every goal scored almost, whether it was for or against, we'd be lined up. After a penalty kill, we'd be the lineup, you know, just to keep or to change the momentum or whatever. And Jacques was really good at that. And then later in the game, or if we needed a goal, Peluso often was taken off the line, and then like a Stéphane Richer was double shifted. So we'd play four lines, but he would double shift and play on both lines.
Would Jacques game plan? Would he match lines? Because you guys were huge. Peluso was 6'4", Holík was 6'3", 6'4", you're 6'2". Like, you're big dudes. Would you match up like the Legion of Doom? Would you guys play against them?
Not in Peluso's time. I think Mike was gone. But later in her career, I played alongside Bobby Holík and Sergei Brilin for a few years. Mm-hmm. So I stayed with Bobby, and then we got Sergei. And then we played, I can't remember, I don't think we played against Lindros' line, because I think we had Claude Lemieux play against that line. But we would play like against Mario's line in Pittsburgh. We played against his line. You know, he'd use us then, because Bobby was just a wrecking ball. You know, go up against any center. So later in the years there, for sure, we would go against some of the top lines, especially if they were a bigger line. You know, he had three little wheeler dealers out there. We weren't out there, but
yeah, talk about the, because you mentioned it earlier, and like I said, I played for Jacques, and he's known for this defensive style. Was it annoying for you guys, like always just having to answer, oh, all they do is play the trap? But when you look at the goal, you guys scored a lot of goals year in, year out.
You look at that, the year we went against I'm not looking at stats or anything, but we were second or third in goal scored.
Yeah,
you know, and we were first, second, or third in goals against. I mean, but we, you know, the trap, you don't forecheck. It was only to pull back when the other team had full control of the puck.
Yeah.
In the offensive zone. And the major where the trap was, where we perfected the trap, was in the neutral zone. So in transition plays and turnovers, the trap was in the neutral zone. And we had speedsters. You mentioned we had Claude Lemieux, you had Stefan Richer that could fly. You had Tom Chorsky. You had, young Rolston. You had those. So our turnover and our transition game was super quick. And that's how we capitalized, or that's how we got our opportunities offensively. It's just turn the puck over neutral zone, but then having skilled enough players and speed enough to make use of their turnovers.
Well, you had a young Scotty Niedermeyer too. So that doesn't hurt. Oh, I just forgot about Scott Niedermeyer.
I forgot all about him
too. Oh, gosh, I didn't forget about him. Could you tell, like, how good he was? Because the guy is just known for his skating. Could you tell this young kid was going to be what he ended up being?
Yeah. The only thing about, and nothing negative about Scotty, but back in his first year for sure, maybe second, is he was such a great skater. Like, in awe to watch him. And then he'd get to the offensive zone and kind of run out of room and kind of the play would end. You know, yeah. It took him a couple years to adapt to the size. I don't know whether it was the size or the caliber of players, because I think in junior, he'd get through the neutral zone and it was easy. But it took him a few years to get used to, once he got to the offensive blue line, you know, to then continue to play and make things happen from there. So, yeah, right from the get-go, the kid could fly. I mean, yeah, that's beautiful to watch.
I played against him, and he was an amazing skater. You played with him. Like, for how many years? Probably a decade.
Well, I was there for 11 years, and he was there when I left, and he came in the year after I got there. So he was drafted in 92, 93, I want to say.
Yeah, that's incredible. You got to watch him as the meat of his career. Let's talk about your second cup. And I don't know this situation. I was just kind of shocked when I saw this. When you win the cup in 99-2000, the head coaching situation. So you start with Robbie Fatorik, and you end up with Larry Robinson. Kevin Constantine's intertwined with all this. How does this shake out for a Stanley Cup winning team?
So we were first in our division with 2 weeks left in the season. Robbie Fatorik, who I thought he was a good coach, liked him a lot. He's one of my top three assistant coaches I ever had, Larry Robinson being the other one. And my coach, who ended up being my head coach up here, Herb Boxer, an assistant for my first year and then became a head coach. And those are my top three assistant coaches as far as teaching skills and helping you out in that aspect. Mm-hmm. So it just was decided between the owner. Back then we had John McMullen, who was an individual owner, and he decided that Robbie wasn't the right choice for us for the playoffs. It might have been for the regular season, and then made that switch.
Eight games before the playoffs.
Yeah, and it shocked Larry Robinson too.
Yeah, because Larry was gone, and then they get him to come back into the fold?
No, Larry was there as assistant, I believe.
No, he wasn't. Well, he wasn't the year before. They had Fetisov and Fatorik. And then, so maybe he was. It's just not showing up.
I think he was the assistant, and he just bumped up to being the head coach.
So what did the players think, though?
Larry never wanted to be a head coach. He wanted to be, I think, he wanted to be one of the boys still. And it killed him to, like, sit a guy out or to give a guy shit. That wasn't his MO. So, like I said, best assistants, great guy. You know, just a pleasure to have him coach me, whether it was head coach. So he was great as a head coach in the playoffs, but when you get 80 games, he didn't want it. You know, just wasn't his way.
So you go into that cup run, and you're playing great. You had one of your better years. What I wanted to talk about was just Stevens murdering people. Because by that time, he is just – he's Scott Stevens. Like, he has cemented his status as being that guy. What was it like being on the ice or sitting on the bench just watching him just impacting games with just these bone-crushing hits?
Well, the biggest one – so that was the year that we – So that was a year we were down three games to nothing to Philadelphia. Must have been 3-1.
And he buries Lindros.
And so we ended up tying the series in game 6. Lindros has been sitting out with, I believe, concussion issues or something. Yeah. So all of a sudden, he's coming back for game seven. It's in Philadelphia. Lindros come back. That's all you hear about for 2 days. Lindros. First period, Lindros cuts across the blue line with the puck. That was Lindros' last shift. It wasn't pretty. And I feel, you know, concussion, and I mean, ooh, it was not pretty to see if you ever watch it. I mean, that was the end.
Oh, he buries him. He just folds him up. Yeah.
And then the whole building went silent almost, and we won game seven and won the cup.
So what is it like on the bench or in the room? Because that's not the only hit he leveled somebody with. Like, what's it like having that guy on your team?
Oh, just a solid, fierce competitor. And he was quiet. You know, I talked about leadership when I talked about Yzerman. Scotty's the same way. Scotty wasn't a very vocal person. You know, he just led by example. And, I used to screw around with him in practice all the time to piss him off.
Oh, really?
But I knew I couldn't really friggin' go at him. I mean, I couldn't friggin' go in the corner and expect to come out too often, but I'd always rib him and give him shit or try to screw around with him.
Yeah, well, it was a different team in 2000 because you had all these high-end young scorers with Jason Arnott, Sikora, Gomez, Patrick Elias. Was the game plan still the same, or was it more of like, let's get on our toes and get up the ice?
Yeah, it was getting our toes, but when you look back at what people call the crash and it's boring hockey and everything, we probably played exact same style, but we had a few more upside skilled players, you know, but you still, you know, you had to be responsible defensively. And that was the key. I mean, defense first. And then if you had the speed, and we did in Sikora, Eliash, Jason Arnott, you know, you go down the road and then it was Bobby, myself, Sergei Breland. We were the second line. And then, Claude came back.
Yeah.
John Madden. I mean, he was fast, you know, kid, oh, yeah. Unbelievable penalty killer. Scott Gomez was young. You know, that was another line, the three of them. And I can't remember.
No, it was a stud team. And then the one guy we haven't mentioned, Marty Brodeur. Like, what's that like playing for? Was he just a solid dude in the locker room, or what was he like?
Yeah, he was, you know, guys say goalies are a little different. And, you know, and then French guys are a little different. Well, Marty had the two of them. Which made him a little normal.
That's too funny. So he was a normal guy. You'd go out to
dinner. Yeah, laid back, normal, you know, he was down to earth. You know, he wasn't cocky. You know, I'm sure he was to an extent a little bit, and he was on the ice, but he was a good enough player to do it. But yeah, he was a perfect fit for our style. And, you know, I'm sure it helped him out, but also, and he's a great goalie. You know, I'm sure it helped his numbers out a little bit that we were a little bit of a defensive team. But, and again, there that year, we were top three in the offensive, you know, of the league too.
Yeah, you get this stigma of just being all defensive all the time, but you guys scored a bunch. Was it ever talked about in the room how much he played, Marty? Because nowadays, goalies split. They play 50 games max.
Yeah,
but he's playing amazing. 75, 80 games.
Well, he wasn't 75.
75.
It was close to 70. He did play a lot. Well, he wanted to, too.
Yeah.
That's what Marty wanted to do. And I guess if you look at it, you know, when they're playing a game, if you keep your shots down, it's no more work than a practice for a goalie. I mean, a goalie's facing 18 times more shots in practice than he is during the game.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's more of a mental thing, and he wanted to be in the net.
Gosh, 95-96, he played 77 games.
Wow.
That's insane. Like, that's incredible. That's regular season. And then there's playoffs on top of that. So how was practice with him? Because I played with goalies who are like Henrik Lundqvist, never let you score on him, even in practice. He hated it. But then other goalies, they wouldn't care. Like Ryan Miller, he's like, whatever. Score on me, I don't care. How was he in practice?
Just the same as always. It wasn't overly. Like, I remember Dave Anderchuk saying Dominik Hasek, they'd play like 3-on-3 at the end of practice or whatever. And they'd go half an hour without scoring a goal.
Oh, no kidding. He goes, gosh, you played against Hasek too. That's so cool.
Yeah. And so, yeah. And in 2000, I ended up actually playing on the fourth line. I shouldn't have actually been even, you know, they kept me in because I was assistant captain. I was a big part of the locker room. But I had a completely blown out shoulder. I was getting shot up once a week just so I could move. So, yeah, I wasn't playing many minutes, but I played every game in the 2000.
You scored 43 points in 77 games.
Yeah, but I blew my shoulder late in the year in a fight against Ty Domi.
Oh, Randy.
And then I had surgery during that summer. So then, yeah, the next year I started off, I scored 7 goals in my first 10 games. And I had all the press, like, where were you last playoffs? You know, what were you doing? Because I had 24 the year before, and playoffs I had none. And it started, or whatever I had the year before. And I finally told him. I was playing with a broken arm, and I had shoulder surgery. I got in trouble from Lou for that, but it's like, what am I going to sit there while I was picking my nose dirt? I don't know. I was, you know, I just couldn't move. I couldn't play.
So yeah. You mentioned, obviously, Lou, you're probably pretty close with him still. Yeah. He's one of the greatest GMs ever, supposedly. Me and him had a rough go around. It's funny, after my career, right before I was done, I had dinner with him, and he looks at me across from the table and he goes, "You're done. You should retire." And I was like, I was still playing. I'm like, okay, sounds good, Lou. I guess I'll retire. Like, this is while I was playing, Randy, trying to get a contract.
What
it was very funny.
What were you having dinner with him for?
In Toronto, I did some hockey deal, and he was there because he was the GM of Toronto. And I just so happened to go out, and he was having dinner with him and Babcock, and I was out with Bob McKenzie. And they're like, come on over to our table and join us. And so I was eating with Babcock, Lou Lamoriello, and Bob McKenzie and myself. I just did the All-Star game crap, so I had some, you know, juice with me. But, yeah, he just looked at me. He goes, "You're done. That's it. Go out on a high, kid. No reason to come back." I was like, "Thanks, Lou." Like, I'd never met him before, and he just stone cold. You should retire. I was like, "That's wow. That's great." Yeah, right. So bizarre. But one guy I wanted to talk about, I played for him in Houston, was Kevin Constantine.
Oh yeah.
And I know you had, you know, some run-ins with him, and I had some run-ins with him. What are your thoughts on Kevin? Because he's a very polarizing guy. He kind of gives you the playbook. You have to learn it. We would take written tests before this season. Like, we need to know the plays. You played for Jacques Lemaire, who was the best coach ever.
Best
and you
coach.
Get Kevin Constant. Yeah, Jacques was the best. And what's going on with Kevin?
Camera doesn't go that far. Useless.
But talk about a guy, because he's in the NHL. What was wrong with him?
Ticket, please.
Thank you.
Tickets, please, madam.
Sure, let me just... Oh, this jacket's got so many pockets.
No rush.
Got it on eBay. Vintage, one of a kind.
I just need your ticket, madam.
Couldn't find it anywhere. Then, ta-da, eBay. Total bargain.
That's nice.
Oh, thank you.
But I still need to see your ticket.
Oh, yeah, sure. With great deals on things you love, you can't help but say when it's eBay. Things people love.
Poppy's come to the end of her work visa. She partied most nights and now can't afford her flight back to the UK. Her parents are annoyed, but not too worried. With their HSBC Premier Bank account, they can transfer money to her account abroad at HSBC UK's best exchange rates. So more of their hard-earned cash actually reaches its destination. Everything's Premier when your bank account is. Search HSBC Premier. HSBC UK, opening up a world of opportunity. Apply with £100,000 annual income or £100,000 savings or investments with HSBC UK or Premier status abroad.
His ideas and his dedication to the sport is unbelievable. Mm-hmm. Like, and that's what makes him such a bad coach, is it's just too much, you know? And that's the reason I ended up leaving Jersey. And Lou told me that Constantine didn't like me and he was going to stop playing me. And so they had and then I ended up getting traded to Dallas. But, I think he must have seen me roll my eyes in a meeting one too many times. We get him halfway through the season. Okay, so Larry steps down or gets fired or whatever, bringing Constantine. And now we're having two-hour meetings. We're in game 60 and 70, and we're having two-hour meetings after every game. And he's going over every single thing that happened during the game to the point of your skate blades are angled this way. When the puck's over there, your skate blade should be angled over this way. It's not talking about your 2-3 feet, what shock was. Okay, you're 3 or 4 feet in the wrong position here. This is where I want you. He was like, And then Scott Gomez, who's a 20-year-old kid. So Constantine came in. Yeah, so he's like a 20-year-old, and he's breaking down game film and ripping Scott Gomez apart every 2 seconds. And what makes Scott a great player is you got to anticipate. You got to, you know, read. You got to gamble a little bit. Okay, in Jersey, we played defense first, but and he'd just rip him a new, you know what. And I just thought that was just
Bush League.
Just Bush League. And then, like I said, he understood the game, but almost to a point of he broke it down way too detailed. Because it is simple. You want to score goals, more goals than the other team, right? Okay, let's come up with a couple plays. Let's go play hockey. Because
it
if
is
you're
funny.
Out there, if you're out there thinking, if you're thinking and you're not reacting, you're a step behind. You know, you really are.
You would almost be worried about the game tape the next morning because he would break down every single play and he'd zoom in on you and go, why are you right there? And he'd stop the tape. So, yeah, it's bizarre how he gets in your head.
Yeah, it's just mind-boggling. So, yeah, so he didn't last there but a half year. So
half a year. And let me just say this because he was 28-1. He coached the second half of the year. That's a good record. And they didn't bring him back. They're bringing Pat Byrne. So that just tells you all there is
to
know.
He went 28-1.
28-1. Yeah.
Wow.
Terrific record. And they still gas him at the end of the season. So.
Yeah, you just can't. Like I said, like he's brilliant. And he's more dedicated probably than any other coach. But there's just so much you can do. And anytime you start thinking out there, you're a step behind.
You got to act on your instincts. So let's just finish up with maybe I want to talk about, well, obviously one of your best fights was Dave Brown, because I think he's one of the toughest guys ever. And you beat his doors off, Randy, and it wasn't even close. So you look at you're grinning from ear to ear. You love that. Just tell us about the Dave Brown fight, Randy. I know you want to tell us.
So again, I've played enough now where you pick your spots. And, you know, Dave Brown really, I wasn't in his weight category. And so very seldom, you know, by now I'm fighting the big heavyweights.
Yeah.
Well, we're in Philly and I think we're winning. So I was smart enough over the years to know when to fight and when not to fight. Well, I probably shouldn't fight because we're up by a goal or two or whatever. Mm-hmm. But he comes down, he pinches in on me in my own end, hits me along the boards. Hey, kid, you want to go? No. Start skating away. Get to the blue line, taps me. Hey, kid, you want to go? No. Get to the red line. I'm like, okay, we're in Philly. This is probably looking embarrassing. I better fight him. So I finally get to the red line. I turn, throw the gloves off, grab him. And back in the day, you didn't have to be tied down. So he starts trying to come out of his jersey. And all I remember is I threw three of the quickest punches I could throw while he's coming out of his jersey. Down to the ground he goes. He gets up, bleeding from his nose.
You buried him.
And then we went to the box. But like I said, if he didn't get caught up coming out of his jersey, was the only reason I beat him. But I'll give him all the respect in the world, because get down to the second or third period, we line up at a face-off again. He goes, hey, kid, you want to go? I looked at him and said, I'm pretty happy with the way the first one went.
Get Tony down from here, Dave. No thanks. Yeah. Like, I buried you already, but gosh, that's funny. When you look back,
And then he left me alone. Sorry to interrupt you, but then he never touched me.
Oh, nice.
Which was, I give him a ton of respect for that.
Was there any guys who you were scared of who you just said no? Because your fight list is every single tough guy in the NHL during that time. Was there anybody who you just was like, no, no thanks?
Well, Link Gates after he hit me.
After twice.
And then.
Fool me twice. Shame on me.
I fought Domi. I probably didn't fight him a lot, but I probably fought him four times in my career.
Yeah.
And hard to fight him. You know, he's small, he's shorter, mm-hmm. but he's got a low sense of gravity, and he's a lefty. So what do I try to explain to someone? You know, if you're going to be in a street fight, you're going to get your base under you, right? If you're a righty, whatever, you're going to stand with your left foot forward, you're going to have a good base.
Yeah.
And then what Domi was a lefty, he'd get you spinning. So he'd get you spin in the opposite direction. So when you were trying to throw a punch, you're actually off balance every time. And that's how he beat you. He would just get you low center of gravity, get you moving the opposite direction what you wanted, and then come over. You know, he had great balance, low center of gravity, and yeah, hard guy to fight, even though he was small.
You ever fight Probert?
Nope. Never did. I guess I was good enough for him. He said to me in one of the games, hey, you want to go, Randy? And I said, no, Bob. That was after I was traded.
Gosh, that's so that funny. Dumb. All right, Randy. Well, that's it. Anything you want to add? Because I've had you for longer than I told you I talked to you for, and this was a fantastic.
No problem. It was a great, great talking to you again. And yeah, it's good. I don't mind coming on these and talking once in a while.
How are our Huskies going to do this year up in Michigan Tech? Oh, they're getting ripping soon.
This is a whole new world now with this. Well, one was the portal.
Yeah.
And now with the Canadian junior hockey players coming in.
Oh,
so Michigan Tech has 18 new freshmen coming in, or 18 new players.
Wow.
I don't know how many are freshmen, but 18, 11 coming from major junior.
No kidding.
They're trying to get John Scott's on the D. So how tall is John?
I'm 6'8 and a half, 6'8 and a half.
They got a 6'4, 6'5, and 6'7 coming in.
What?
6'4, 6'5, and 6'7.
Holy cow.
I got to go watch. They're on the ice now. I should go watch one of the practices just to see. But, and then he has to cut players because I know they lost quite a few, but he's bringing in 18 new players. So they've got to be letting players go or something.
You would think, though, so you can only carry like 20. Six, seven. I want to say, yeah, it's not many. Oh, let me ask you this. How did you?
But you can carry them. If they're redshirted, I think they don't count against your 25 or 6. If you
redshirt. I'm on their website now. Like, they have 30-some guys, if not more, listed on the roster right now. It's incredible.
Yeah. What were you going to say? How did I what?
How did you end up at Tech? Because you're coming from Montreal, and NCAA is not really a thing for the Canadian juniors at that point.
Well, it wasn't a thing for Quebec.
Yeah, so
I played midget AAA in Quebec, and we were the only English-speaking team in league. When I say English-speaking, I mean we weren't 80% French. Yeah. On my team, we were about a third French,
okay,
to a quarter. You didn't get a lot of scouts. I had Providence College come, go to CJEP, wait a year. I had someone else come, go to CJEP, wait a year. Then I went to the Air Canada Cup and made the first All-Star team at the Air Canada Cup, which is Canada's midget championship, Canadian championship. And out of that, I had two offers. One was Western Michigan, gave me offered me three quarters of a ride. That's all the money they had left. And Michigan Tech offered me a full ride. And my dad says, looks like we're going to Michigan Tech.
So you were going NCAA regardless. There was no urge to go the Q.
That's my dad wanted me to get an education.
Is that right?
If I could get an education out of hockey, he would have been happier than ever. So,
and you did get your degree.
I got my degree and then obviously played for 14 years.
You are the second, I would say the second most famous person to come out of Michigan Tech.
Ooh, there's a few hockey players, you mean. There's some famous, I'm sure.
You're looking at number one right here, Macker. Let's not. I just tease it.
What year did you leave Tech again?
2004.
Okay.
I was there, 2001 to 2004, 2005. Yeah, we were terrible. I think we won at most 8 games a season. We stunk so bad. We're so incredibly bad. But we were playing in the big, tough WCHA. Nowadays, it's a little easier.
That was, you know, as a fan, I've been a season ticket holder since I've moved back here. And as a fan, it was the best thing, them leaving the WCHA. You just can't compete. There was no nights off. You know, and you're going every night against the number 2, the number 4, the number 6 in the country.
Well, it was Denver, Wisconsin, Minnesota, North Dakota. Like, it was a murderer's row. You're absolutely right. We got one weekend off with Alaska. That was it.
Yeah.
It was tough.
Yeah, it was tough. So now, you know, now it's better. They can grow as a team more. You know, yeah, there's still good teams they're playing, but, you know, it's not every single weekend. And, you know, that works. You know, you can get better and prepare for one season. You know, you get to the playoffs. Now you're preparing for one weekend or two or whatever you're going to prepare for. during the regular season, every single weekend you had to try to be up to your best.
Well, yeah, I'm looking at the roster. There's a lot of guys from the WHL. They really did some scouting out there, so they should be good. It should be interesting. Yeah, we'll see how long this whole portal thing works with the major juniors, because it looks like there's a lot of guys coming south to the NCAA.
Yeah, it's crazy.
But anyways, it's not crazy me talking to you. I loved it, Macker. I appreciate you giving me some time. It's been an hour. Super, super, well, super quick talk. I had a great time. I appreciate it. Hopefully I'll see you soon up at Tech or on the golf course, my friend.
See you soon, or you want to do this again during the season one day, just let me know.
Oh, I would love that. Give the insider. This is fantastic. All right, everybody. Randy McKay, appreciate all the support. Have a good one. Cheers, everybody.
Hi guys, Pete and Abby here from The Therapy Crouch. We're sponsored by Starbucks Chilled Coffee.
They're all about lifting up the everyday for those fleeting moments where you get to do something just for you.
I'll grab one after the school run or on my morning walk.
And you'll find the delicious full range in the chilled aisle whenever you want something smooth, bold or sweet, whatever suits your mood. So go on, treat yourself to Starbucks Chilled Coffee. Find your faves, buy them online or at your local supermarket.
Hey, it's Theo, Luke, and Joe from the Waffling Podcast, and our podcast is currently sponsored by Audible. Want your next thriller fix? Check out The Dropouts, the debut novel by screenwriter Liv Parkinson.
Kaylee Morris is just trying to survive her first year at uni, a blur of social anxiety and parties. But when she becomes the talk of the campus, Kaylee retreats and shuts herself away.
That is, until she is chosen for a new module to try a new psychedelic drug believed to cure anxiety. But soon, the line between reality and fantasy begins to blur, and she feels the pull of a new dangerous obsession.
Listen on Audible now. Subscription required. See audible.co.uk for terms.
This episode is brought to you by L'Oreal Paris and their Revitalift filler range. If you're looking for a glass skin glow, try Revitalift filler serum and plumping water cream. Powered by hyaluronic acid, L'Oreal's filler serum hydrates skin and replumps fine lines in just 1 hour. Then lock in that hydration and plump with a filler water cream. Right now, the range is half price at Boots until the 21st of October, subject to availability. Shop the Revitalift filler serum and water cream at Boots now.